Blog Talk Radio.
Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas on Monday, August the 23rd. As we like to do on Mondays, we'll be chatting with our friend Bill Katz of Urgent Agenda. I would like to know what's going on with the weather in New York because it's been in the news all over. Of course, there's a lot of other things to talk about. Afghanistan, President Biden, talk of the 25th Amendment, infrastructure, the politics of COVID, and the Democrats are back in Texas. They came back and they decided to join the rest of us. But let me say hello to our friend Bill Katz, who if I watch the news, you guys are getting a lot of rain.
Well, that may be applied to some places. We are north of New York City, about 22 miles north of New York. We got almost nothing. Three or four drops, which is, you know, five drops less than we got last time. I was in one of the supermarkets just before this struck. There was not a single forecast that predicted that our area would be badly hit. And yet all the lemmings were in the supermarket buying their Duracells, their TV dinners. You could barely get into the place. Nothing much here. There was a lot of rain in parts of the New York metropolitan area. In New York City, for example, I think Central Park got the biggest rainfall per hour at one point in its history. The real damage was done way east of us on the tip of Long Island in New York and then up in the lower New England states. And there they got quite a beating. It is not a hurricane. It's basically a tropical storm, and now I think they're calling it a tropical depression. And the main damage was, in fact, where it did hit, the main damage was in flooding. We got a lot of emergency sirens on our emergency radios warning about flash flooding. There was a lot of flash flooding, but not the kind of damage, physical damage, you would see in a real hurricane.
Yeah, interesting. The Rangers, the baseball team, were up in Boston, and they had a game on Sunday that was rained out. And they even their game today they were going to do a makeup game, and that one got rained out too. So in the Massachusetts area, they did apparently get some rain. And I think the Yankees also postponed their game. So some rain did come down. But I always find it amazing, Bill, how somebody can predict the weather or what the climate is going to be in White Plains, New York, 50 years from now, but they mess it up 2 days from now. It seems like these weather reports are always wrong, but somehow I'm supposed to believe them about what's going to happen 50 years from now, Bill.
Well, if you don't believe them, then you're anti-science. And very
possibly I don't believe in science, right, yeah.
Yes. Now, the reason they're wrong is you're not watching them correctly. You must watch them with a mask on. If you have a mask on and a picture of Dr. Fauci in your room, you will get an accurate forecast. But as they say, all kidding aside, folks, it is true, and I think many people have made this observation, that what usually happens is far less than what is predicted. Mm-hmm. Whether this is a surplus of caution, which is possible, or whether, as some people suspect, these reports are ginned up because it's very good for business. I mean, the broadcast stations make a lot of money during storms. They raise their advertising rates. It's actually a good time for them. But I think there is a general pattern that the storm is never as bad as predicted, but you should always take the necessary precautions because
right,
it might just
right.
be one of these days. So,
as my parents used to say, take the umbrella to school today. It may rain.
That's right. It may rain. And I know that I would love to have stock in Duracell. I mean, every time there you get two drops, they sell four flashlights. And
right.
I think also anyone who makes raincoats would do well in this area. People do tend to, in the New York area, panic a little bit, and they do run to the stores. And I happened to run to the supermarket just before the storm was to hit, and it really was bedlam. It really was. And yet, as I mentioned earlier, there was not a single report that there would be any real damage in our area. But people are kind of programmed to take all the necessary precautions.
I guess nobody wants to be the one without water the day that the big storm hits or something like that. Everybody wants to be prepared for the big one. But, you know, from the coverage that we were watching on the news, it seemed like it was bigger than what you're explaining. I mean, the coverage we were getting on the news was, wow, this thing was pretty bad. And in fact, it got so bad, I wasn't sure you were going to be able to do the show today. I thought you would have to do it from a boat. And, from a boat and bring your battery phone with you and have extra batteries so that we could go the whole time, Bill. So I'm delighted you can do it the normal way, Bill.
Yes, there are areas that were hard hit. It's flooding. And flooding is always dangerous.
Yes,
it's just this was not what hit was a tropical storm. It was not a hurricane. Now, the difference, of course, is that in a hurricane, you get these tremendous winds.
Yes.
Fortunately, we were able to avoid that. But where I am, it's always we're almost programmed that to listen to the predictions, run to the stores, and then get a much smaller amount. In fact, there is such let down in a sense that one of my emergency radios sent me a message saying they're not going to talk to me anymore. I mean, it's that bad.
Well, I'm glad you're well, Bill. I'm glad that we can actually do our podcast normally. I wasn't sure from what I was watching in the news. Well, Bill, it's been a very tough week on this matter of Afghanistan and President Biden, but I wanted to begin with a little fun, if I can. The Democrats are back in Texas. We now have a quorum again. We have our legislature is back at work. And there was a very interesting analysis that came out today from a local analyst saying that if you're going to do what – basically talking to the Democrats saying, if you're going to do something like this, you better have something at the end that you got for this, because they got absolutely nothing, Bill, for this, absolutely nothing. They went to Washington, hoping to influence the Senate and the House with respect to voting. They didn't do anything. They didn't get anywhere. And then, of course, unfortunately, some of them had COVID. The president didn't see them. Nothing happened. So, in a sense, we're in the same place we were in on the day that they took off for Washington, except that I do think they've lost some support from a lot of independents, Bill. A lot of people who look at this and say, this is not serious. And so I think in that respect, it was a net loss for them, Bill.
I think you're probably right. The Democratic Party looks increasingly unserious. When you add that incident, which of course affects Texas specifically, to the horror of what we are going through now in foreign policy in Afghanistan, a horror that will continue and may continue long into the future. You realize that the governing party in the United States is simply not up to snuff, and it's not up to governing. There is an unseriousness about it. This is one of the results of a party that went astray several years ago and started concentrating entirely on race, gender, and ethnicity to the exclusion of many of the very, very serious issues of our time. You look at the Democratic Party and you say, well, who is there to go to for advice? Who is there to go to for wisdom, for guidance? And the list is very, very short. I think that we have a leadership crisis. I don't like to use the word crisis, but I think we do have a leadership crisis in the country. When you look at the next 2 or 3 years and try to make a list of the people you would trust to run the United States, it's a very short list.
Yeah, well, it's certainly not the ones in the White House, that's for sure.
No.
Because, I mean, they're not – I mean – it seems to me that the president has three problems here. Well, not the president, but the Afghanistan policy. We'll talk about the president a minute later. But what we're watching has three problems. there's a message problem. They're not explaining correctly. They keep contradicting each other. They've got a credibility problem because they, you know, for the same reason, they don't seem to explain things correctly. And now you've got a potential problem with this deadline on the 31st of August where the Taliban says, no, we don't honor that deadline. That's your deadline. That's not our deadline. You got to be out of here. Or I guess, the other way around. I mean, the Taliban says you have to be out of here by the 31st, and the Biden administration says, no, we may stick around. Well, I don't know how we're going to enforce that, Bill, if all we have is the airport in Afghanistan. Are we going to go to war with the Taliban again? So it's really, if I'm an American watching this, you know, maybe not a person as interested in politics as you and I are, but just a casual observer, I got to look at all of this and wonder what the heck is going on, Bill.
Well, absolutely, because our loss of credibility now is so great. I mean, people who are our allies are going to look at this and are looking at it and saying, can we trust this country? Now, people say, well, this happened at the end of the Vietnam War, and we got through it, and everything was all right eventually. Well, it was all right, but it took years to rebuild our credibility after the Vietnam War. And we are now going through the same thing. I think we had certain built-in advantages back then. We were a more coherent superpower. Ronald Reagan came in, who improved things tremendously in 1980. And after his administration, we had the Gulf War, in which we stepped up to help an ally. But we're in a situation right now where people around the world are asking, is this the country we want to trust? Is this the country we want to trust with our security, with our very existence? The NATO allies are appalled that not one of them was notified when we pulled out of Afghanistan, that they were not consulted as to how to do it because NATO was involved. They may not have been involved to an enormous degree. It wasn't a world war, but they were involved. They obviously feel very insulted and let down. Other countries that depend on this, you have to believe that the Japanese are looking at this, that the South Koreans are looking at that, certainly the Israelis, and the president will be seeing the prime minister of Israel for the first time on Thursday. And they're asking that same question. A country today has many options as to who it wants to align with. And the United States is becoming one of the least attractive. And that is a tragedy for American foreign policy.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you have, I think, Taiwan, too. If I was sitting in Taiwan, I would be very worried about my future because I think that's a real problem. But another thing, too, Bill, that I think we're seeing here is how if the Taliban says you got to get out of here by the 31st of August, and we say no, we need more time. How do we enforce that when it seems to me the Taliban has all the cards? They've got at least 1,000 Americans they can hold hostage. I mean,
that's
the problem that you know we don't have. The only thing we have is the airport. If you can get to the airport, you're fine. But getting to the airport, that's the problem. I don't know how many people are going to be able to get to the airport in the next 8 days. I pray that everybody can get to the airport. If they get to the airport, I'm pretty sure we'll get them out. But what happens on the 31st if we still have thousands of people on their way to the airport and the Taliban says, you got to get out? What are we going to do? Are we going to say, well, force us? Well, they will because they'll just hold hostages. That's their card. They'll just hold hostages, Bill.
I think you're absolutely right. I think your analysis is right on. Somebody said on the air last night, and I don't recall who it was, this would never have happened under Trump. Trump is not that kind of a guy. He wouldn't have let it happen. And if something was going wrong, he would have said to the Taliban, you're in charge until we're in charge. And we are prepared to bring the full force of the United States down on you unless you let all our people go. For some reason, it never occurred to President Biden to do that. We have enormous military power. It's now being wasted. It's being squandered. It's being questioned. And we could have also said to them, we have a lot of equipment. We intend to get the equipment out. If you attempt to stop us or to attack us, you will face a very serious military consequence. Nothing like that was done. Those are the standard words of an international crisis when you want to win. But apparently they are negotiating with the Taliban as if you can negotiate successfully with a group of terrorists. Are they naive? Are they simple-minded? Are there people pulling the strings behind Obama who really don't really care if we lose Afghanistan? You know, one of the things about this crisis that really hasn't been discussed is that to us, and I think we're fairly typical Americans, this is a monumental disaster. But there are undoubtedly people in the United States and people in prominent positions who kind of welcome this, who don't care if the United States is humiliated because they don't like their own country. Now, we've seen that play out over and over again with members of the Squad, the very left-wing group within the Democratic Party, and yet nobody wants to talk about it. Not everyone feels they're a loser on this. And if you are a left-wing American who has serious questions about the United States, which may be putting it mildly, who wants the defense budget cut in half, who thinks we're an imperialist nation, if you were that kind of a person, this is not bad news.
No, not at all. Although I have to remember a little bit, Bill, after the collapse of Vietnam. Now, I do think there's a difference here. The collapse of Vietnam happened 2 years after. We didn't have any troops in Vietnam when it happened. It was 2 years later. And we were basically getting out our friends back then. Certainly, they weren't as many as there are now. But we did have some serious setbacks after that collapse. I mean, the message that went out to the world, I mean, if you look at the things that happened after the collapse in Vietnam, you had, you know, Cuban troops running around Africa. You had the Central America began to fall apart. The Soviet Union was emboldened. I mean, there were a lot of problems that all came to
a
head.
And the fall of Iran to the mullahs.
Yes, exactly, that one. And then you had the oil crisis that happened, you know. So you had a bunch of things that happened. Now, maybe they would have happened without the fall of Vietnam. I mean, I guess you can never guarantee history. But I don't think all of them would have happened. And I could see a scenario here where a lot of things could go wrong in that region. Now, I happen to be, I think I've mentioned it before, Bill, I think you know this, that I was always one of those who believed that leaving a force of 2,000 or 3,000 men in Afghanistan, for my money, that was the thing to do. You keep them there so you
yes.
can keep your eyes, you know, you got your
I
eyes
agree.
On Iran. Yeah, you got your eyes on Iran. You've got your eye on Pakistan. I mean, when you look at the map of Iran, it's like a neighborhood that you want to know what's going on. Iran, they have a border with Iran. They have a border with Pakistan, with China, with India. You want to know what's going on. So having 2,000 or 3,000 soldiers, 2,000 or 3,000 soldiers would not have been that big of an investment, especially since they're not the ones doing the fighting. The Afghans were actually doing the fighting. So I never really understood this madness that we used to hear about, this 20-year endless war, and now you have even President Biden taking shots at the valor of the Afghan soldiers, prompting somebody in the British Parliament to get up and give a wonderful speech, you know, saying, hey, don't talk that way about the men that I fought with. So it just seems like I want to wish the best, obviously, for the country and for that region. But I just see a lot of bad things happening, Bill, because we're not willing to keep a force of 2,000 or 3,000 soldiers, Bill.
That's correct, and that's just madness. It really is. And as you said, it keeps an eye on things. It also presents an American presence. They don't dare attack those 2,000 or 3,000 troops out of fear that they will get a much larger response from the United States. But I think people now feel they can get away with almost anything. I'd point out that they look at our southern border and the way it has been allowed to collapse. They look at other things, items of weakness in the United States. We want to be reminded that the fall of Saigon in 1975 also led eventually to the Iran hostage crisis, where American hostages were taken by the new Iranian regime, and they apparently felt they would get away with it. There wouldn't be any price to pay. And actually, there wasn't. They eventually released them, but the fact of the matter is Iran as a nation was not in any way punished for it as President Reagan came in 1980, and I think they feel the same thing is going to happen. They know that there is basically a fifth column of left-wingers in America who will try to short-circuit any retaliation by the armed forces of the United States. They know that there is a press that is sympathetic to left-wing movements and may not be in love with the Taliban, but may not feel that we have any reason to fight them. But all over the world, and it's remarkable how quickly the reaction has come, all over the world are people who are saying the United States is not the country we thought it was. And boy,
right.
Is that devastating.
That is, and it's interesting that that's coming from countries who generally criticized what we did. For example, many of these countries did not support Iraq, the Iraq War, many NATO countries did not send troops to Afghanistan, but they kind of knew they could get away with that because we were there and we would do the job. But now a lot of some of these European countries are saying, my gosh, we're going to have a bunch of refugees show up in our country. I mean, all you got to do is take the train to Istanbul and then from there to Europe. It's not that difficult for a lot of those people to show up. Well, I remember when President Obama canceled or took the troops out of Iraq, eventually they had to go back in, as you know, but when he took them out, the consequence of that was ISIS and all kinds of refugees all over Europe who were just fleeing what the ISIS was doing. I fear the same thing could happen now, where you have refugees from Afghanistan going somewhere else and creating problems somewhere else. I mean, if I was Israel right now, I would have all of my men ready for war because I think that serious, Bill.
Well, you know, as I pointed out, the Prime Minister of Israel is coming here on Thursday. I think it's going to be the first foreign leader that the president is meeting post-crisis. And I suspect it'll be a very interesting meeting because the Israelis are going to tell the Americans that they don't back our diplomacy with Iran and are going to present a counterproposal as to how we should handle Iran. But the feeling in Washington is that you're not going to convince Joe Biden to do anything but what he's been doing, that he's become a very stubborn man. The former Secretary of Defense, Bob Gates, said that Biden is a man who's been wrong on every foreign policy issue of our time, and I think that's absolutely correct. I can't think of him being right on any of the things that we have seen. And yes, I think that the Israelis are very frightened that the entire American deterrence apparatus is going to collapse, and I think it may. And the question is, who will do it? Will any price be paid? I mean, you have this monumental crisis right now. There has not been one person dismissed for dereliction, not one person. And the president continues to tell us all is well. The vice president is off on a trip to the land of Oz or someplace. Maybe she can meet the wizard, maybe not. I don't know if the wizard wants to see her. And also, what this is prompting internally in the United States for the first time publicly is a serious discussion about the president's health, about his cognitive abilities. It's a very awkward discussion to have, but one that has to be had. If any other thing happens that is bad for the United States, like a Chinese invasion of Taiwan, which we do not resist, and we just let them take Taiwan, then I really do believe you will have a foreign policy crisis so serious that discussions will involve removal of the president under the 25th Amendment. I don't know how that could be arranged, and we're not exactly getting a bargain in return for that.
No.
I mean, you're getting Kamala Harris, and her numbers in the polls are very, very low. So we are facing a leadership challenge. We do have an election a year from November. That's a long time, but I think a lot of these problems may grow, not diminish over the time, and it may become one of the most crucial elections in our history.
Absolutely, and I want to talk a little bit about the 25th Amendment, Bill, after we take a break, because there's a lot of talk about that, and, we may have to deal with it. So we're going to take a little break, and we'll be back with our friend Bill right after this. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas. Getting back to our friend Bill Katz, just a quick reminder that the music that we play on the show is the music of Carlos Guedes. He's a good friend of mine here from Venezuela, and I have a link to his website so you can check him out and maybe order a copy of the CD. It's really very good music by my friend Carlos. Let's get back to the Bill Katz and this conversation about the 25th Amendment, because I was reading a little bit about the 25th Amendment, Bill. I was reading a little bit about the background and actually what it says. And I understand that the background, you may remember this, I'm sure, when President Eisenhower had that heart attack where he was out for several days. And at the time, there was no real mechanism in the event that, let's say, he was declared incapacitated. Thankfully, he returned. But that was kind of like what prompted the 25th Amendment. But the 25th Amendment, Bill, has to do with incapacity, really physical incapacity.
Yes.
Meaning, you know, the usual idea that, you know, you got a man in the hospital, you know, being kept alive by machines. You know, we've all had family experiences with stuff like that. But that's not the case here. I mean, the man is obviously able to walk and function. And I'm not sure that senility, which is, I guess, what he's suffering from, and maybe that's not even fair of me to say that, but he sure looks like a man who isn't quite on top of things. I'm not sure that's enough to get him to get the 25th Amendment passed, because it requires two-thirds of the Congress to approve it, and I'm not sure a lot of Democrats want Kamala Harris as president, so it's really a complicated issue, Bill.
It's a very complicated issue. Also, this is one that involves judgment. You know, we are constantly being told, well, you say that he's has cognitive disabilities. Where is the examination by the doctor? And I think there's an important answer to that because, you know, we are a democracy. We're a functioning or a constitutional republic, but we're a functioning free society. We elect our officials. And in a case like this, you don't need a note from the doctor to turn on a television set and see a very impaired man. If the American people turn on their television sets and see that and come to the conclusion that I cannot trust that man, I have no confidence in him because of his situation, that's it. The people have made their choice. And it doesn't matter what a doctor writes on a note. And I think that we should go back to 1944 in this, because that was the third term of Franklin Roosevelt. We were in the middle of World War II, winning at that point. But it was perfectly obvious to people in Washington who knew him that the president was in a very bad way physically. In those days, it was considered not proper for the president's health to be discussed publicly. That was considered a private issue. The press did not report on it. And as a result, there was no public discussion. But internally, within the government in Washington, people who looked at the president, just looked at him, already started to make plans for a new president. And you'll note that that was the year in which the Vice President of the United States, Henry Wallace, was taken off the ticket, and he was our Vice President during World War II, and replaced by Harry Truman, the leader's believing that Wallace was much too far to the left politically to be president. And they did this all without any medical advice from anybody, just on the basis of their own observations. So I think that the doctor here is the American people. They will look at him and they say, I don't have confidence in this man. And then the wheels begin to turn. I must tell you in my ignorance that I am not familiar with the exact mechanism under which the president can be removed. The 25th Amendment has been used, by the way. It's been used several times when a president has had to have an operation was in the hospital and was going to be under anesthesia. And the 25th Amendment was invoked to have an acting president. Several vice presidents.
Well, President Reagan and George W. Bush actually did it twice. And President Reagan, but those were generally, I'm going in and by the way, not that I'm an expert on the amendment, but I did take a look at it, and it's a very interesting amendment because it's obviously written by serious people, something I'm not sure we could say today, you know. But it was written by serious people who took into account several, you know, contingencies, and one of them was President Reagan being in the hospital for a couple of days, if you remember, And then President George W. Bush, who had a couple of operations too. And in those instances, the president simply signs a memo that says, I'm going to be out for a couple of days. I pass the presidential power to, well, Dick Cheney and, in the first case, George the First Bush. And that's in the amendment. That's provided. But the key one is where the president is incapacitated. And that's where, you know, again, the idea that he's a vegetable in the hospital or something like that, where he can no longer function. But everything has to go to the Congress, Bill. That's the key here. The Congress is the one that actually would okay changing or passing the presidency to Kamala Harris. And I don't know right now that there's enough medical information. But there is, on the other hand, Bill, and I don't want to be too long-winded about this, but there's polling data. You've written about this. It's out there. People don't think he's running the country. So that, I think
that's
maybe
right.
The American people have already done their own 25th Amendment bill.
I think they may have. And by the way, there are very serious questions about that amendment because it isn't very specific. For example, it doesn't say who decides who the president, if the president is incapacitated. And there's something else it doesn't decide. And this is fascinating. What if Joe Biden is declared incapacitated by whatever authority and Kamala Harris becomes acting president? Well, acting president isn't actually a job. It's acting president. She is vice president. Now, would she, in a situation like that, retain her power to break a tie in the United States Senate under current conditions when the Senate is split? That's a fascinating question. You could have an acting president who also can break a tie in the legislative body at the same time. I don't know how that would be resolved. I really don't. But I think that the constitutional scholar should start working.
Well, you know, it'll probably go to the courts like everything else does. But
yes,
I don't think the acting president gets to live in the White House.
I think the
acting president is still living in the vice president's house. But it is a serious dilemma because, I mean, when President Reagan went in the hospital or when President Bush went in the hospital, maybe I'm being too partisan when I say this, but I had no concerns about President Bush, the first Bush, you know, having to assume the presidency in the event that, let's say, President Reagan died, or Cheney assuming the presidency. I had no trouble with that because I felt that both of those men, Cheney and Bush, were presidential material if it got to that. But I don't think most Americans think that Kamala Harris is presidential material. I don't think a lot of Democrats do either, Bill.
I think that's true. If you go down the chain of command, so to speak, the president has the vice president, who is one heartbeat away, as they say. Now, if both can't carry out their functions, the Speaker of the House becomes president. That's Nancy Pelosi, another winner. I mean, how old is she? She's 184, I think. And
yeah.
I think she was one of Lincoln's favorites.
Yeah.
And then next in line is the president pro tempore of the U.S. Senate, who I believe is Senator Leahy of Vermont. That's
right.
the senior sitting United States senator. It's a very, very awkward system. I wrote at Urgent Agenda last night, there are times I wish that we had a parliamentary system like the Europeans where you can remove a prime minister simply by having him lose a vote of confidence in the parliament of the particular country involved. Ours is a much more convoluted system. It is one that is based on the importance of stability and a system that guards against frivolous and overly quick decisions. But I think that this is a discussion that we have to have as a nation as to what happens in the presidential line of succession. Everybody knows, I think, that when the president delivers a State of the Union message, one member of the cabinet is not in attendance, and that person is that year's designated survivor. If there would be, for example, a nuclear attack that wipes out the entire presidential line of succession, as it is discussed and is listed in the Constitution and in the amendments, that person would survive. And every year it's a different person, but it is somebody who is in the line of succession. But we have some questions, I think, and I think it is possible that if the government continues to deteriorate under Biden, the effects will be felt beyond our foreign policy. They'll be felt economically. They'll be felt in terms of fighting COVID-19. And the American people will believe that they have a leaderless government. Now, the question that you raised, who is really running the country, is another fascinating one.
Yes.
This is almost a novel. I don't think anybody believes it's Kamala Harris. I think that she is not bright enough to act as stupidly as we have in the last week.
Well, actually, she wouldn't be in Vietnam if she was running the country.
That's right. That's
right. Seriously, and I don't know why she wouldn't be in Vietnam. She wouldn't be in Vietnam today if she was actually anywhere near the steering wheel. I think the reason she's in Vietnam, I know that was a trip I'm sure they planned before, but that trip could have been canceled very easily.
Sure.
The reason she's there is because I don't really think she is one of the favorites. That's just my feeling.
I think that's true. I think it's possible that they let her go on the trip because they wanted her out of town.
Yes.
Because they didn't want her interfering with anything.
Right.
Or giggling in front of a microphone about the people stuck behind in Afghanistan.
No, gosh.
The name that comes up all the time as to who's running the country, of course, is Barack Obama. There's a whispering campaign that says he's really behind Biden's decisions. All the people involved are his people. They're from his administration. The Secretary of State is from his administration. I have no evidence of that. I mean, I don't think any of us has any real evidence. It will be anything along those lines will be denied by the White House. They'll say, no, Joe Biden is in charge. I think what the American people are waiting for now is the next foot to drop. You know, what is going to happen next? Are we going to have an increasing catastrophe? Are we going to have an active hostage situation as we had with Iran, but this one involving thousands of people? Rather than 54 people or whatever it was with Iran? Are we going to have a military move by a foreign nation? I think the apprehension is going to grow, not diminish.
No, you're exactly right. I did want to say something a little humorous, that there is some talk that President Biden should – I mean, President Trump should be appointed Speaker of the House so that he could – he could then become president. You know, if one of those two, you know, somebody resigns, he would be number three. There's some talk about that. Probably not going to happen, but I did think it was a little funny. But a couple of things, Bill, that I wanted to say about President Biden and his situation or his physical situation, whatever. And I'm uncomfortable because I'm not a psychiatrist, but he doesn't look very sharp when you see him on TV. A couple of things. One. This may come down to the First Lady simply getting tired of seeing her husband, who I'm sure she loves him, as any woman would love her husband, seeing him look so foolish and so humiliated in these press conferences. You know, when you lose ABC News and these networks, you know, when they're doing CNN panels as to whether or not you understand the issues, you know you've lost it. And maybe she'll day say, Joe, this is – I hate seeing you like this. Maybe it's time for you to resign. So it may come down to that. And that way there's no amendment.
I think it can.
But that's kind of a wife, in a sense, loving her husband. And, you know, I think the First Lady would do the country a great service in the sense that she would avoid the country having to go through the 25th Amendment and all that kind of stuff. So that – it may come to that, Bill. I have no evidence of it, but I'm just saying it cannot be pleasant for the First Lady to sit there and watch her husband in some of these speeches and press conferences. Honestly, he looks – I feel sorry for him, Bill, when I see him. I don't even hate him.
I just
feel sorry for him.
Too. He reached the presidency, and this is what he's got. And he's been in office now some 7 months, and – look what's happened. I mean, the greatest humiliation in American foreign policy in many, many years. And it is something that's going to last. And comments around the world that are almost abusive toward him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the former British prime ministers, I think, said that this policy is idiotic. Other people have made similar comments. As far as him resigning, remember, that does not solve our problem as a nation. We would still have Kamala Harris. Now the intrigue can be very great. If you want to really carry this novel further, what if you got the vice president to resign and a new vice president put in who was qualified to be president, and then the president resigns? That would be fascinating.
That would be, and I mean, this thing could turn into a TV show before we know it. But, I mean, it would make a heck of a novel, as you say, a great...
Go ahead.
No, what I was going to say is that it would make a great television miniseries, that's for sure, but you were going to say something as well. So go ahead, please.
Well, remember, that's what happened with Nixon. Remember,
yes.
It was Spiro Agnew who resigned first because he was involved in his own scandal. And the president nominated Gerald Ford, which is why we got Gerald Ford as president when Nixon eventually resigned himself. And I think Gerald Ford was a far better choice than Spiro Agnew.
Yes. Well, there's another interesting point, too, and that is that if, let's say, President Biden were to resign, for the reasons I stated, you know, the first lady simply saying, I can't go through this anymore. And, you know, you got to look at the physical toll that this is taking on a man who is 78 years old, and it's got to be awful what he's going through, Bill, independent of his ideology. I mean, just looking at this man, I feel sorry for him, what he's going through. Let's say Kamala Harris becomes president, then she loses that tie-breaking ability. So then at that point, it's a 50-50 Senate, but nobody can break the tie because you don't have a vice president. So the Democrats really cannot pass anything. And the Republicans would have actually, they would be the ones picking the vice president. I understand from reading a little history that Gerald Ford basically told, the arrangement was that Gerald Ford would pick the vice president, Nelson Rockefeller, and that there was an agreement ahead of time that the Senate would approve him. And I don't know whether the Senate today would approve anybody that Kamala Harris submitted. I mean, who is she going to submit? Joe Manchin?
She will submit anybody she's told to submit. I mean,
if there's
a person who won't be her own quote man as president, it's somebody like Kamala Harris. She's basically, I hate to use the term, but she's a party hack. She was selected entirely on the basis of gender and race. Her situation was that she had been a presidential candidate, as you remember, in the Democratic presidential primaries for the 2020 election. She was doing so poorly in the polls months of campaigning that she pulled out of the race before a single vote was cast to avoid humiliation. And that is who we have as Vice President of the United States. Nobody is applauding her or thinking that she's going to be a great president if she succeeds Biden, because I think she has as much a tin ear as he has.
That's right. Well, one thing, though, that I do want to say, and we've talked about this before, but I think more and more people are going to really talk about this in a more serious way, and that is the role of the media in 2020, because there's no doubt in my mind that if then-candidate Biden had been exposed to the American people the way he's being exposed right now, meaning having to take questions and having to deal with real issues, he probably would not have been elected, Bill. I just think that if the American people had seen him in October and November the way they're seeing him now, I think a lot of Americans would have said, you know, I hate Trump, I hate those tweets, but this guy is not fit. I mean, he's not physically fit. And I think the media is going to have to explain that, Bill, as to why they did what they did. And I don't think they can get away with it anymore. They're going to have to explain to a lot of people why they didn't cover Biden, why they didn't expose him the same way that he's being exposed right now, Bill. I don't remember. I'll just say one quick thing. You know more about this than I do, but I don't remember a candidate for the presidency who avoided the press as much as Biden did, Bill.
Well, that's exactly right. He ran from his basement.
Yeah.
And I'm glad you brought up this subject of the press, because it's a subject that's avoided by the press, and that is the behavior of the American press going back years. This didn't begin yesterday, but you remember in 2008, the obsequiousness of the press toward Barack Obama as a candidate, the fawning over him became so bad that Saturday Night Live did sketches about the press, they had sketches of their cast members interviewing Barack Obama with these powder puff questions. Are you comfortable, Mr. Obama? Can we get you something, Mr. Obama?
Right,
and
yes.
It became a national joke. And after the 2008 election, it was Tom Brokaw who said, we've just elected a president about whom we know so little. Well, that's the role of the press. They were supposed to inform us. They were supposed to ask the tough questions, and they didn't because he was their candidate. And the press bias in this country became so bad that during the Trump administration, the press absolutely disgraced itself by being openly against him and trying to do everything to destroy him. And yes, I think eyes will be on the press in this period to see what it does in terms of who sits in the Oval Office.
Yes, and then, of course, the American people are responding to the press by not watching it. They're not watching in a way, the American people are telling the media what they think of them. I mean, look at the ratings of all of the networks. It's not just CNN. All the networks have gone down. Now, Fox had a bigger audience, so they've lost something. So they're still number one, but they're not number one like they used to be. And overall, I understand the network news at 5:30 in the afternoon or 6:30, I guess, out east, is not getting the audience they used to get. It just seems like the American people have simply said, we don't want to watch the news. We're interested in the news, but we just don't want to watch the what they like to call the mainstream media. So the American people are voting on this, but I just think we need to have a discussion because another topic related to press irresponsibility is Reuters just came out with an article saying that the FBI is now looking at what happened on January 6th and saying, well, we really didn't find any evidence of anybody organizing this, which completely contradicts the narrative of the last 8 months.
Oh, of course. Absolutely. Of course it does. And, the narrative has been that there was this insurrection and there were the insurrectionists in the streets and they were going to overthrow the government by breaking into the Capitol and sitting in Nancy Pelosi's chair or something. I mean, and this was the narrative we heard from the first minute before there was any investigation done. It was the narrative set by the left-wing press. The right-wing under Trump is forcing an insurrection on us because Trump doesn't believe the election results. But as you pointed out, it now appears that the FBI's investigation shows there was no conspiracy. They were not working together. They were angry, to be sure, but this was not an attempt to overthrow the government. And I don't know what you do with that. If you were a newspaper person, somebody working for a newspaper, or a television person, somebody working for a television news organization, do you cover it and say, we were wrong? I doubt very much if they'll admit their mistake. They'll just move on, as they say.
They'll go on mute.
Yes, that's
when
right.
It comes to this topic. But, I mean, this is such an outrageous topic that it now raises the question. I remember being invited on Telemundo the Sunday after this event. And, you would have thought that this is the most important date in American history. This is a Latin American country where a bunch of people are overthrowing the government. And I remember saying back then, well, we don't really know what happened. But the real question is how did they get in the Capitol in the first place? How do you have a Capitol of the United States that isn't guarded? I mean, what kind of a statement is that sending to – what if they had been real terrorists and had walked into the hospital with real guns and bombs? And that's, I think, is the issue now. I think this whole – January 6th now moves in that direction. If the Republicans take over the Congress, I think they will, that's going to be the focus of the investigation. Forget Trump. It's going to be on who made the decision not to protect the Capitol. Bill, you've been to the Capitol. I've been to the Capitol. I always remember guards. All of a sudden, I guess that day there weren't any, Bill.
No, apparently it was very, very lightly protected. And it was a day when President Trump was going to be out speaking near the Capitol. You would think they would have done better. I do think we know that there was a request to use National Guard troops that day to guard the Capitol, and I believe it was Nancy Pelosi who turned down the request. So I think her role here has got to be examined. But you know, we are seeing in Afghanistan what a real insurrection is.
Right,
it's violent, it is unpleasant, it is dirty. What we had on January 6th was a bunch of very foolish people wanted a protest, and the protest got out of hand. But that's the full extent of it. And
right,
I
and
think
it got out of hand because
again,
there wasn't anybody. I mean, had there been the normal protection of the Capitol, these people would have been stopped at the entrance, and they would have been stopped right there and sent back. But you know, there wasn't that protection, and that's what I think what made it worse. Just a couple of quick topics, Bill, before we move on. It looks like the infrastructure bill is in trouble now with the Democrats. There's apparently 9 Democrats who are not going to go along with it because they represent competitive districts. So the whole thing may die in the House. And even if it reaches the Senate, Senator Manchin has already said he's not voting for that. So this whole infrastructure victory from a couple of weeks ago may not really happen, Bill.
That's quite possible, and once again, it reflects splits in the Democratic Party. I'd point out another group that isn't happy about it is the fringe left. They think it should be a much larger bill than is being considered. The fringe left has inordinate power in the Democratic Party, much greater than its numbers imply. But they have those numbers, and they want their way. You know, one of the biggest mistakes we could make right now is to think that this tragedy in Afghanistan is going to change the minds of the fringe leftists in the Democratic Party on anything. They're just going to go ahead and use it to get their basic agenda, which is a racially based agenda. They're not going to withdraw. These people are in effect religious fanatics. But we are dealing with a situation where the country does seem deadlocked. You're right that the infrastructure bill as currently written may not pass at all, and they may have to go back to the drawing board if there is any drawing board.
Well, if they go back, then it'll never happen, because another consequence is a very interesting article. We're running out of time today, but we'll pick this up maybe next week. There's a very interesting article by Liz Peek. I think that's how you pronounce her name, P-E-E-K.
Yes.
I think one of the Chicago newspapers, and she's saying the consequences of Afghanistan and a president who is weaker and weaker is that less and less Democrats are afraid of him. So if you're running for re-election in 2022 in a competitive district, you're not going to defend Joe Biden very much. There's nothing really to defend. So, you know, what's the point? Why support him on infrastructure when you know, you're in a competitive district? You're better off voting against it, because that's just the way it is when a president is weak. I don't know, Bill, we're just about out of time. Anything that we forgot? I mean, it seems like I don't remember any time that there's so much going on. Maybe you've seen this before. I don't remember a time when there was so much going on. Even in the darkest days of the Nixon years or some of the tough days of the Iraq War, It wasn't quite like this, Bill.
You're quite right, and let's not forget a very big event tomorrow. The governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, steps down, and a new governor will be in charge by the end of the day. And that is a big, big political story here, and it's one that affects the nation. New York is a very important state, and Andrew Cuomo was becoming a star before his star fell. That's a big story this week. Let's see how that new governor does. She's a woman. She's a moderate Democrat, and she could go on to national fame.
She could. Well, she could if she decides to borrow a page from Mr. Adams in New York City. If she goes in that direction, she could be a national star. But there's an attorney general there who I think wants to be governor, and I'm sure you'll be filling us in on that, because there's the problems inside the Democrat Party are such that, and I think it's going to explode now with this Afghanistan and the infrastructure bill, they're really going to go to war with each other, And it's going to be a little fun to watch, Bill.
It will be fun to watch and in a way tragic to watch because
yes.
we are in very deadly situations. But I would watch this new governor. What I've read about her is very favorable. You're going to have a moderate Democrat in the governor's mansion and a moderate Democrat, not a left-wing Democrat, in the mayoralty in New York, and let's see how they govern.
They do, and she comes from a more conservative part of New York, I understand, Buffalo, right? That's
yes.
where she comes
We're
from.
Buffalo.
So she's not – a New York from New York kind of Democrat like Cuomo was. I
no,
think she's more of
no.
a of the moderate part of the state. Well, Bill, as always, thank you for your time. Lots of reasons to follow Urgent Agenda this week, so keep up the great work.
Well, thank you, Sylvia, and I'll talk to you again next week.
We'll do it the next time. Our good friend, Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda, so much to talk about. I mean, just absolutely so much to talk about. By the way, if you're a music fan, Don Everly of the famous Everly Brothers passed away. They had a great sound. I like a lot of their songs. Have a good, wonderful day, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.